and welcome back to another episode of Your Pocket Nurse, a podcast for student and graduate nurses. I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the original owners of the land on which I am recording on today. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone. Today I'm joined by Georgia, or some people know her as George. She is a registered paramedic. Is coming to chat to us all about paramedicine and looking after our mental health. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Me too. I was like wanting to, ask you to come on. And then, when I saw your little Q&A, I was like, oh, perfect way to sort of like ask. But thanks for coming.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. Thank you for asking.
Yeah. I think of the podcast, like even though it's like Your Pocket Nurse, I sort of just want to chat to lots of different health professionals because we're all working together for the same sort of goals, I suppose. And yeah, it's just interesting to learn about other people's perspectives in healthcare and just learn about everyone's jobs and things like that.
100%. I think, yeah, as you said, we are all working together, and I think the end result of the patient's stay in hospital ends up better when we use interdisciplinary care. So I am so all about that. And yeah, I really appreciate you reaching out. So that's very cool.
Thank you. So how are you today? How's your day been?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. I got up, had a coffee, went to the gym, which is really good. Did some gardening. It's my day off today.
Oh, nice.
So it's been really beautiful. The sun's out here as well. How's your day been?
Yes, good as well. I've got a day off today, which is nice, and it's really sunny. So I went outside and I'm already like a bit burnt. I was like, oh dear, I was there for like 20 minutes.
Oh no. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, but I went for a little walk as well. And then my friend, unfortunately, it's her birthday today, but she was like in contact with someone with COVID, so she has to isolate on her birthday. We're gonna do a little Zoom workout later. So
beautiful. Is she?
No, she works in kids with disabilities.
Oh, the poor thing.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, I'm sure we'll still make it a fun day.
Yeah, definitely make the most of it for her.
So I thought I would start off with the first question being like, what was your why to becoming a paramedic?
Yes, that's a really good question. Thank you for asking. When I was studying for my HSC exams, the night before my trial started, my very beautiful uncle passed away in a farming accident out west. He was unfortunately electrocuted, and my grandparents were first on scene and had to administer CPR. This was toward the end of the year, so it was a very hot Australian summer, and the paramedics couldn't find the entry gate to the farm because it's this really big farm out west. The whole event was extremely traumatic, like for everyone involved. From that point onwards, I just had this goal in my head that I wanted to go out west and help the farmers, because I grew up on a farm and I'm pretty comfortable with navigating like gates and rural roads and everything. So I thought that it would be a really good way sort of to honour him and what my grandparents went through. So it started off with that traumatic event, but then just like a love for science and biology and getting to know people. So it eventuated into much more than that, but the inception of it was definitely out of the result of that event.
Yeah, I guess that's, a very, sad thing that happened, but I suppose, sort of gave you insight into like, what you want to do with your life, even though it had to sort of originate from something, so traumatizing and, unsettling.
Yeah, there's always, there's always something that you can take out of a traumatic event. I feel like I definitely did go through that post-traumatic growth that a lot of people seem to go through when something horrific happens. And I did get a lot of closure from applying for that role. During university, in my first year, I actually got to go out to the station that responded to him on my first placement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I got to meet all of the people that worked on him and, got to hear sort of the scientific side of what happened. So it gave me a lot of closure knowing those small details and what actually happened from that point of view. So yeah, it did offer me that closure.
Yeah, well, that's really important. And I suppose you know, as a paramedic, you would, you know, see a lot of you know, upsetting and traumatic scenes, which we'll get to a bit later and discussing how to, you know, deal with our mental health and everything with that. But it's hard. Can you talk us through a little bit more about your journey to becoming a paramedic? Like, so that event happened, and then, you know, how many years did you have to study for, and like placement requirements, and, you know, what jobs did you have, and just a bit about that?
Yeah, no worries. So it put me, a lot of people, you know, when they go through a traumatic event, you can sort of go one of two ways. I, as a coping mechanism, just studied a lot and kept to myself, and I just had this goal to go out west and help the farmers, and I knew that I needed a specific ATAR and I needed to know pathophysiology and biology quite well in order to be competent in that area. So for the rest of year 12, like for my HSE, I studied really hard, and I got a sufficient enough ATAR to get accepted into the Australian Catholic University to their 3-year Bachelor of Paramedicine degree. I to go for the Bachelor of Paramedicine and Nursing purely because I just really wanted to achieve that end goal. But I know a lot of students do the double degree, and I think that's awesome having two options at the end of your degree, particularly if you're not entirely sure, which way you want to go down. So I did the 3-year degree just in North Sydney. During that time, we had 3 placements, non-emergency transport, and then 2 ambulance placements. So I did one of those in a rural environment, which I spoke about, and also one in a metro environment, which was really interesting to see the differences in how the teams operate and just the different requirements that are there between rural and metro. During that time at university, in terms of work, I used it as kind of a springboard into conquering sort of the parts of my personality that I wanted to work on. So I was a non-English speaking swimming instructor, and I also ran swim classes for people with disabilities, which was really insightful and really great. It gave me a good opportunity to work on my communication skills with like a wide variety of people. So that was sort of the first job that I did in order to gain confidence in that area. And then I did lots of volunteering roles with the Red Cross. So I did the Save a Mate program, where you go to music festivals and you take care of partygoers that are intoxicated or drug affected, which also was a really good learning experience for me, just to learn about the different sort of how to communicate again with people that are extremely intoxicated or
and not in their normal, you know, state of mind as well.
That's it, definitely. And operating in that loud environment, sort of a bit more pressure. So that was really good. I'd highly recommend anything like that. And then my final job at uni was as an event medic. So again, it was like a little bit more of a step up of responsibility. I learned how to take blood pressures really well, in as well as I could, in like different environments, and learn how to sort of use the staff properly and apply. Crucial, just basic, really basic sort of getting, you know, confident with taking a set of obs, getting confident with just using normal bandages or making slings, because as easy as it seems on paper, it's actually quite difficult to work out how to use triangular bandage. Just like little things like that. It's like, yeah, so I tried to use that time during uni to just really build up my confidence, so that when I did, or if I could eventually step out on road, I'd have just that base knowledge.
Yeah, I think those jobs are all like very, you know, interesting and obviously very like healthcare sort of based. And, you know, even like instructor, like even though that's not really, you know, related to being a paramedic or anything, but you're learning like transferable skills that will help you so much when you're, you know, meeting patients that are from non-English speaking backgrounds and like getting over those communication barriers and things like that. So I think often people, like I feel right now, lots of people are really focused on getting, I don't know about Queensland, but there's lots of Rouson positions in Victoria. And yes, these are basically like nursing, student nursing jobs. And I think like a lot of people like message me and they're really like, oh, am I going to get a grad year if I don't have a Rouson position? And I'm like, of course you can still get a grad year. Like they're not expecting you to necessarily have those skills or have those specific jobs because that's not a requirement for a grad year. But every other job, like even if you work in hospitality or retail or anything, like you will learn so many skills that are then transferable to whatever career you choose to take.
That's a really good point that you've just brought up. And it's funny the things that you take out of it. So, for example, with swim teaching, we'd have to obviously be immersed in the pool for 5 or 6 hours at a time. And I have a really low tolerance to the cold. And it taught me resilience and like how to deal with cold temperatures around my body. So when I got placed in the Blue Mountains for my first year on road, in the station that I was at, it was like sub-zero temperatures on a night shift, but I felt like I had that like strength because I was like, I've done those transferable skills, even the stuff that you don't think about initially,
even those like little ones, like dealing with the cold,
there's definitely so many transferable skills that you can gain from like such a wide range of jobs, so that's a really good point.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, being an event medic and things like that would give you even more, you know, transferable skills because it's in the same field. And I think, it's just important, like, for people just to, like, get out there and sort of give those sort of jobs a go before they get into, you know, their proper career because, you know, you learn so much.
Definitely. And also something I've been thinking about for a few weeks, actually, I was reflecting on a lot of the questions that I get asked, very similar to yourself, you know, what do I need to do on my resume to get a job? What marks do I need to get a job? And it's really hyper-focused on getting a job as soon as you can, which I understand. Mm-hmm. And I was exactly the same while I was at uni. That was like, I was so worried about that. But in retrospect, I think the question that we should be asking is, you know, what sort of skills should I be working on and what type of resilience should I be building so that I'm more prepared for my life on road? It's not just a job title. You really have to think about, like, instead of, how do I write my resume to get a grad year? It's like, okay, if I, you know, what do I do for the next 6 months in order to prepare myself?
Yeah.
Not just my resume, but yourself mentally and physically. I think that's a really important way to look at it.
Yeah, I think lots of people forget about that. Like, they get so frustrated how to show. But yeah, you do need to learn about how to look after yourself when you're in that job.
That's exactly right. So I think that's something that I've definitely been contemplating over the last few weeks, is around that language of, you know, what do I write on my resume? It's like, no, it's like, what should you be doing to work on yourself before you get accepted? That's just something I've been thinking about.
Yeah, it's very important. And another thing I wanted to just get back to, because you said that you did the straight degree just of paramedicine, but I work with like a lot of nurses that have done like the dual, like nursing and paramedicine, and because unfortunately, like, there's not a lot of medicine, like, paramedic jobs around. I feel like, I personally don't know because I was never searching for one, but I think that it's a good way to, you know, if you're working as a nurse and then like a job comes up and, you know, you're a bit more employable because you've got all your nursing background as well, to then become a paramedic. I feel like that's what a lot of, you know, those people have told me, that, you know, they've just been working as a nurse, but their end goal is still to be a paramedic when the right job comes up.
Yeah. I think it definitely does give you that opportunity, as you said, to build those skills and patient communication. And also, even like, I would imagine a lot of people, their end goal would be paramedicine, but I'm sure so many people would also fall in love with nursing. Like, the amount of rotations you can do and things you can learn, like, it's incredible. So I definitely wouldn't deter people from doing the double degree, because you just don't know until you give it a really good go and you're in it for at least a year. So yeah, I'm sure. And even like an ED nurse, they
do 100%.
They're amazing. Yeah. So yeah, definitely credit to that nursing degree. I think it would be a great thing for people to do on top of the paramedicine degree, for sure.
And I've actually noticed, like, I'm sure, like, most nurses, I feel like everyone wants to give ED a go. And I work at like a metropolitan hospital in Victoria. And so I put ED first, like knowing that if you don't put ED first, like there's no chance you're going to get it because everyone's first. So like I obviously didn't get it, and I'm actually kind of glad because it seems a bit chaotic right now with COVID. But yeah, a lot of the dual degree people, they ended up getting the, you know, ED position, because I assume, because I was actually one girl when I was like asking her for tips about how to do, I think you know her, but she was a nurse working in ED and now she's a paramedic, and she was like,
Georgia?
Yeah.
She's so beautiful. I actually can't cope. She's so beautiful. Anyway, yeah.
Really nice. But yeah, so I was like, oh, like how do you think you got into ED? Like blah blah blah. And she was like, honestly, I think like my you know, background and placements in like paramedicine helped me get in. So that's always a good thing as well for people. You know, a bit nervous. I think you guys get a little bit of an upper edge.
Yeah, that's really good intel. That's very interesting.
Yes. Wow. So speaking a bit about, like while we're also on the tangent of resumes and cover letters and interviews, like what are your general people and like how can you stand out amongst all the upcoming graduates?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And I think during my time in the interview processes for New South Wales, Vic and London, the inherent resume requirements actually change depending on which state you're applying for. Yeah, so I think some good feedback would be to really go back and reassess the graduate application program information that they give you for each state. So for example, for New South Wales, it was like a one-page maximum and no cover letter for your resume. So I worked with someone who had gotten a job the year before me, and he ran me through his resume. It was very simple, very to the point, and it just had all of your relevant work history on there. So I tried to simplify it as much as I could and put a lot of like my volunteering background and just my work experience on there. But the most important thing that I found for New South Wales was the actual interview day, or like the field day. So I think the resume, in my opinion, and I don't know if this is a change, but in my opinion and my colleague's opinion, it really sort of does come down to your performance on the day. Whereas London Ambulance Service, your resume and application is very, very important because they ask you like 30 questions, and you pretty much, well, I took it as an essay writing opportunity. I wrote so much on there and looked at their core values, and I put so much effort into that. It was like pages and pages and pages long. So it's really dependent on which service you apply for and what they want out of that year.
Yeah, okay. That's good to know. Yeah, and I suppose it's, you know, similar. Like you just have to like look at what they want and just give that to them. Like don't do like the extra little things sometimes, because sometimes they don't want that. Like, you know, like I remember when I was doing mine, someone was like, do colour. Someone was like, don't do colour. But, you know, it's like I think plain and simple, because at the end of the day, they're looking at like your skills and things like that, and you know, all the experience you've got. So yeah, I always say just give them what they want.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And you know, year by year it changes as well. So this year I know it was actually a Zoom interview that the New South Wales applicants had to do, which is completely different to what I had to do. So it's dynamic, it's constantly changing. So I think just focusing on your studies and learning as much as you can, and then focusing on that as a small part of the journey, is probably good advice, because I stress so much about my resume, and I don't even think it was like printed out on the day that I went. It's just sort of like a requirement when you put your application in. So
yeah. Tips. Thank you.
That's okay.
And I remember you, so why did you apply for London? Did you, like, were you really keen on moving there, or was it just because of like the less job opportunities in Australia for a paramedic?
Yeah. So as I was describing before, Mil, my tolerance to the cold is so low. So looking back on it now, I was just like, what was I doing? But again, you get swept up in that, you know, storyline of there's no jobs, like you just have to be prepared to move wherever you get a job, and like you have to pack your life up and this. So I was under the impression that I may not actually get a job in Australia, and I was like, oh, it's a waste of time. I've just done a three-year degree and I put so much effort in, so I want a job out of it at the end of the day. And looking back now, that's really not the right attitude, in my opinion, to have about it. Like, you have to really think about what you want out of the next few years of your life. And so many of my colleagues that are over there now really prioritize travel and having that that really amazing time over there, which they're able to now because like the international borders over in Europe are a lot more relaxed, so they're achieving that. But for me, I'm such a homebody. I love my family. All my family is here, so it wasn't actually a viable option for me in the end. So when I got the offer from London, it actually made it more stressful for me because I was like, oh my god, now I have to decline it. I don't have a job from New South Wales, like this is crazy. So yeah, it was due to the lack of job opportunity over here. But I think if you are a homebody like myself and you know what type of work life balance that you want, it's really important to stick to your guns. And if you don't get through the first round, then try again the next year or work in a private sector, or there's so many options that you can do in order for you to stay put where you live. So yeah, I want to eliminate that stigma of like you need to pack your whole life up and move wherever you get sent, because it's not true.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because at the end of the day, like, you know, well, depending on your values and things like that, but yeah, you don't want to just move away just for the sake of it when, you know, you like there is opportunities at home. Yes. You know, I think it would be hard. Like, I know like one person, he is a paramedic and he moved to London to work, and you know, I don't really know why he moved there or like his story or whatever, but yeah, all I see is his Insta stories of him traveling all around Europe. It looks fun, but like,
that's so good.
But you know what he's like feeling inside and about, you know, living away from his family and things like that. But I think yeah, once you figure out what's important to you, you can sort of, you know, consider all the options. And
definitely put your values at the forefront and think about what it is you want to achieve over the next few years. So I can play as like, and as you said, you don't know his story and I don't know differences, and I'm so supportive of whatever path that they take. But yeah, definitely don't feel like you have to sacrifice your well-being or your mental health in order to work in that role. 100%.
Yeah, and just because this might be a dumb question, but I don't really know, but like what other jobs are there for like paramedics? Like, this might be silly, but I don't know, but like, who answers like 000 calls? Are they trained paramedics or are they someone else? Like, what other sort of, you know, jobs are there than being on the road, I suppose?
Yeah, so that's not a question at all, and that's something that I didn't understand or know until like my last year of uni. Even now I'm still learning. So not a dumb question at all, but yeah, so we have the control center, and they are all, I believe, New South Wales, and they also have like particular paramedicine training for that particular state that they're in. And they're like the first port of call, so they will sort of administer or talk through the patient's family or bystanders through like life-saving first aid before the paramedics get there. So that's definitely something that quite a few paramedics that didn't get on-road jobs in the first round offers actually went and did, and they said it was great. Very stressful, very tiring, but a really good learning opportunity. So there's opportunities to work in control. But aside from that, if you look into it, there's so many private ambulance companies in Australia that pretty much function as same as state ambulance services, but they more so operate at like large scale events or marathons or like music concerts, things like that. So you can always get a job with a private sector, like within the private sector. There's also so many first aid jobs that you can do as a paramedic. Like, you have the transferable skills, like you could go on to be a phlebotomist, like someone who takes blood. You can work in an injection clinic, like for the COVID 19 vaccine rollout. Yeah. That's another one you can do. There's also a lot of opportunities in the army, and you can go and be, yeah, like a frontline medic, and you can travel with them. There's also like the offshore riggers, like the big one's in the middle of the ocean, where you can be like an on-site paramedic, and also all of the mining companies employ their own paramedics. So
wow, see, yeah, there's like so many like different things that like I haven't so even heard of many. Half of them, you know.
Yeah, so many, and I didn't even really know that until I moved up to Queensland and you start looking. But yeah, there's so many more opportunities than just working for a state service, so it's really important to remember that.
Yeah, thank you, that's great. And I suppose the next sort of question we can discuss is like, what are the pros and cons of being a paramedic in your own opinion?
Wow, that's a really good question. I'll start with the positives because I think that's always a really good place to start. But
yep, don't turn people off.
So the pros for me, personally working as a paramedic, the biggest one is probably that subconscious element of safety that you can bring to like your friends and family. So if we go on a camping trip or on a road trip or we're just at an event or something, I'm a very protective person of my loved ones, so I know that if something horrific happens, then at least I can offer some sort of assistance or guidance in that event. So I think a massive pro is knowing that you can keep your loved ones safe, where you know when to call an ambulance and sort of when not to, I guess. Another pro as well for me would be the amount of different people that you meet, like my best friends at uni. I still have them now. I adore them so much, and I wouldn't have met them if I didn't go down that pathway. And also, if you're like a you look into like the cycle of life and everything, and I'm sure you experience that in your in the cardiology ward as well. You can really develop a deeper appreciation of life and death and like the fragility of life as well. Like that's something that's to me is a massive pro, because it makes you value your loved ones so much and your life. Is sort of woo-woo as that sounds, it's true. So those would be the main pros for me. Also like a sense of achievement, sense of belonging, because you're with a strong institution, like people around you all in the same uniform. There's definitely a sense of belonging and family that comes with that, which is beautiful. So those would be the main pros for me. I'm sure everyone would have different ones as well. I try not to be too negative in my language, but the cons for me would probably be like the shift work, so the overtime that you do, the lack of flexibility in your hours and days. Like, of course, you can take sick days and you can do shift swaps and everything, but it's quite a rigid roster, so you'll probably most likely be rostered on Christmas Day, New Year's Eve. There's a chance to be rostered on your birthday, a friend's wedding, like, you know, you do miss out on quite a few things if you don't take the time to really like figure out your roster. And also because you're working night shifts, you have to sleep. Well, I try to sleep 6 or 7 hours during the day, so you miss out on, you're kind of on a different
night shifts.
Yeah, like you just function in a different way that normal society does. So it's like, you know, your friends are out on a Saturday night and you're like, oh well, I have to sleep, so catch ya, you know what I mean? Like you just operate
so disconnected from the world.
So like, that's how disconnected,
because I'm literally just working and sleeping for those 4 or 5 days that I've got. And then on my last night shift, I'm so grumpy because I'm trying to like only have a little nap so I can get back into my normal like sleep routine. And it's just like, I just don't like that aspect. Yeah, you just miss out on so much.
You do, don't you? Like you genuinely do. And like I went to coffee with a paramedic the other day that works for Queensland, and he's like, yeah, you know what, because people have different opinions and they cope with things differently, he's like, yeah, I love the work-life balance, you know, I get 4 days on. And then he described the day after his second night shift as a grey day. He's like, and I get one grey day and then I get 4 days off. And I really appreciated that analogy of having like a grey day, because after two night shifts in a row, the day you come home, you are like on a different planet. Like,
yep. Like, that's not a day off.
Yeah, it's a grey day. You're just like half an hour of sleep. So completely empathize with you on that point and definitely agree. It's something that I feel like some people are just built for, and other people struggle with it a little bit more. And I put my hand up. I was definitely one of those people. I do not like night shifts. So Yeah, it comes down to the person as well, I feel.
Yeah, it is hard. Like, we do night shifts, like, on my current ward every 4 to 6 weeks, but it's kind of, like, more 6 weeks. So we've got some people that, a lot of nurses that do full-time and they do 12-hour shifts only. So they do, like, one night shift a week. So then it's kind of a bit less for the rest of the staff. But I've got night shifts for the first 2 weekends out of lockdown. And it's like my friends are having a bottomless brunch. And I'm like, oh, I can't drink. Like, I'm going to be at. And I'm like, oh, do I go? Or like, will I just be like bored, like upset there thinking like, oh, I have to go to work tonight. Like, I can't really enjoy myself. And then like, then other people want to go for a picnic the other day. And I'm like, oh, I guess to the picnic and then go from there to work. And it's just like trying to fit in those little things, because, you know, I still have to fill up my own cup. You know, I can't let life work control me and be like, oh no, you've got to sleep, you've got to do, I don't know, it's just unfair. She gave me 2 weekends of night shifts. I was like at least like a Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, you're like, can I swap with anyone, any takers? Yeah. See, that's the thing, and you don't want to let anyone down as well, because like 99.999% of people that I've met that are devoted to healthcare are the most selfless people, and you kind of have to be in that role. So it's really rare for people to be like, yeah, nah, I'm not doing that shift, like get someone else to do it. Like, it's just not inherent in our personalities to be like,
because
that.
Then it's like the people on the ward are going to struggle. Like, we've got shifts going like left, right and center, like, oh, we need 2 staff for the afternoon. And I was like, nope, it's my day off. I need to just, I've got something planned. I'm not going to go to work. But then sometimes it's like, oh, I should pick up that shift, because if I don't, then they probably will be down, like understaffed, and like they're going to struggle, you know? And I think, yeah, like you said, we just think about, you know, our staff members as we should.
Yeah.
Hard, like, how do we disconnect from that and just try and focus on ourselves?
That is such a good point, and it's such a difficult thing to achieve. Like, oh, yeah, totally empathize with that.
Yeah, because you can't, like, we all like say like, oh, we've got to look after our own mental health, and you know, don't pick up extra shifts. Like, you can say no to overtime, and of course you can, like, you're not forced to, but then the other part of it is like, oh, well, if, you know, I don't do it, is someone else going to do it, or is no one going to do it if we all have that same mentality to say no to extra shifts? And it's hard, because, you know, you want to let yourself down, and you don't want to.
That's exactly right. In the rural station that I was working at before I resigned, we did on call in between our day shifts. So it would be like 12-hour day shift, take the ambulance home, call throughout the night, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 3 or 4 during a night, go home, get like 1 hour of sleep, and then you'd be back at station the next day at 6. Lot of people I know, and in my first year, like, as a qualified, you know, it's a lot of responsibility, and the station officer would come over to me and he's like, are you going to pick up that dropped on call? And it's like, oh, I've just done 2 in a row. And you're like, oh, man. But you don't want to say no. It's just like horrific. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not good.
That work, so is that a bit different to like how it would be in the cities, like on call?
Yeah. So the ideology behind it, I think it was quite a number of years ago that it worked proficiently. But in the smaller rural towns, they'd have, and they still do this, they have 1 night shift crew at station, and then instead of having another full-time night shift, they would send 2 people home in the ambulances. So in metro, they have enough night shifts to cover the area, so they don't have the need for on-call. But in the rural stations, some nights it would be not as busy, so, you know, the on-call crew would only get called out once every few nights. But now that the populations have increased, it's like pretty much you're working as a second night shift crew. And this doesn't speak for every rural station. Like, I'm sure some you'd get 1 in a blue moon. But at the station I was at, it was like you're pretty much gearing up to work a night shift after a day shift.
That's like, is there anyone that sort of looks out for you? Like, and says, oh, you can't work. Like, you haven't slept at all. You know, you need to look after yourself.
No comment. No, I don't know, it's hard because the, again, like the people that have worked there have been doing it for years, so more conditioned to it. So yeah, they're kind of, their bodies are used to getting that amount of sleep. So it's sort of foreign for them to be like, nah, you know, I've only had 3 hours of sleep, I'm not going to do the next day shift. So not really.
Yeah.
Not really. Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard. I feel like, maybe it's like our generation. We're so much more like aware of ourselves, learning to listen to our body, like don't push yourself too hard if you don't want to. And, you know, if you need sleep, prioritize your sleep. Whereas I feel like, yeah, maybe other people that have been doing it for longer, they're just, they've never thought about that aspect of looking after, you know, your sleep like that.
Yeah, it definitely is really promising for me to see that generational change come through. I think that's amazing and something that, as you know, like I advocate for so much. I think it's also really difficult to instill those practices when you're surrounded by people that are 20 years your senior, and you kind of have to, you've been moved to a new place, you don't know anyone, you don't, as you said, you don't want to let anyone down. So I feel like it's really difficult for the younger generation to come into a station or hospital where you're surrounded by people who don't think the same as you, because you are just like on a different wavelength. So it's really hard to achieve that, but I have hope. I do have hope. I'm hoping that with this next generation, it'll become more of a common practice to prioritize your sleep over work. Definitely.
Yeah, I hope so as well.
Yeah.
And in general, sort of like advice for upcoming students and grads, like what have you got to say to them?
That's a really good question, and I think about this a lot, and I always think about like what I would have said to myself in my graduate year, and you know what things I would have done differently. But I think my main takeaway or advice would be to take whatever I'm about to say with a grain of salt, because I know a lot of people are programmed to work really long shifts and they don't need as much of a break. So I have a bit more of a different approach. But my advice would be to always prioritize your own mental health and sleep. You know, set realistic expectations on yourself. Don't abide by the expectations set on you from other people, because physiologically we are all different and you have to honor that. I would say really prioritize your work-life balance and know the difference between, or I don't want to go to work because I have a social event, or, hey, this is actually going to impact my mental health if I don't see my friends for the fourth week in a row. Yeah. And honor that and say, like, no, I'm taking this, I don't want to say just chuck a sickie, but, like, you know, to swap the shift or do whatever you need to do in order to protect your mental health. And, as you said, fill up your own cup and socialize with people in your age group. Like, it's so important. And finally, it would be to you know, stay home if you want to stay home. Don't pack your life up and move 8 hours away from your family if you feel like it's going to detriment your mental health, because a job opportunity will come up.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's really good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think, yeah, everyone will have different takeaways from their own experience, and I suppose, like, you never sort of know until you're in the space. And I suppose, like, I've been thinking about, like, I've got, you know, what I'm going to say to the upcoming grads, and it's like,
yeah,
I don't know what to say, you know, it's a tough question, because
yes, exactly, like, and you never want to taint like their dreams as well. It's so important, like, if you want to do it, you know, like, go for it, like, honestly, go for it, but just take care of yourself in the process.
Yeah, 100%. And I created, like, I feel like everyone just doesn't stop talking about it, like, at work, at home, and everywhere. It's like, you know, and all the nurses, like, oh, we feel so sorry for you grads, like, you know, you haven't experienced, like, what good nursing is. And I'm like,
oh,
what is it, like, you know, because it's not like it's not been too bad. Like, I've been quite fortunate that I haven't worked on COVID wards, but my hospital has like 6 designated COVID wards at the moment.
Whoa. Full
ICU full of COVID patients, and they had to open up a second ICU. So, like, I mean, like, I haven't been super affected in my work, and I haven't, like, you know, I still like my job, you know, it's not like I go to work and hate it, whereas I know other grads who have had, you know, experiences, unfortunately, on the COVID wards, you know, one girl apparently is crying every day and I feel so bad for her. And then another girl has actually like quit her job as a nurse, like a grad. And it's just hard because I'm like, oh, like, you know, I feel bad because I'm having a good experience, if that makes sense, you know, because I haven't had to add shifts on the COVID wards and things like that. It's just, yeah, I don't know. I feel a bit guilty sometimes that I'm still enjoying work.
Yeah, I think definitely try to not feel guilty for that because it's really hard. I think that is like a very common way to feel, even when all the other states were in lockdown and Queensland wasn't. It's like, oh, I feel guilty, like even going to a cafe, like when you call your family, they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I just went out for dinner. And they're like, oh, I'm at home. It's like, it's really important to be able to take that period of grace that you're experiencing and run with it. And, you know, if you're speaking to people, right, and they say, and like they sort of shut you down when you're trying to be positive, then they're not hanging around the right people. You know, you want to surround yourself with people that are like, you know what, good for you. Like, this really sucks for me, but I'm so happy you're having a really good time. And that's so great. Make sure you, you know, go and have a cup of coffee for me, or like enjoy your shift. Like, that's fine. Because the other 6 months, you have COVID wards. So it's like, enjoy it while you have it. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Time. They say, like, as soon as, you know, depending on how bad COVID gets, but if, you know, if we start getting COVID positive patients that have come in with like chest pain or having a STEMI or something, we'll have to turn half my ward to COVID because like we've got telemetry monitoring, and obviously, you know, all the psychiatric nurses have, like, they can't just, not like waste it on general COVID patients, but they need to keep that all open for, you know, still cardiac related COVID patients. So I'm like, oh, yeah, it's coming. It'll come.
No, yeah, that's exactly right. So honestly, like, enjoy it while you can. Like, put that smile on your face and go and enjoy your shift. Like, that's amazing. It's like what you've studied for. And I think that's great. Like, yes, do it.
Say that, like, I don't have bad shifts. Like, the other day I had a little cry at work because, like, someone was just being a bit mean. But, like, you know, everyone has little, like, not every sailing, and it's like, I'm sure, you know, even though if they're struggling, I'm sure they've had still some good shifts, you know, like, it's, I think it's just finding like a balance and, you know, kind of, I know it's corny, but like seeing like the little good, you know, focusing on that.
100% what you're saying is talking about being present. Like, you can, as hard as the days are, you'll always be able to find something good in the bad days as well. Like, even if it's just a patient with a smile on your face, or they're really funny, or you're like wearing your favorite socks to work, or you're able to go and get a coffee before your shift, like relishing those moments 100%.
Everyone will find something that works for them, and only trying to, we try, but
yes, that's exactly right.
Sort of speaking on this, like, how do you think, like, we can ever achieve a healthy work-life balance, like, with a shift work? And do you think it's achievable?
No, that's a really good question. And honestly, like, honestly, yeah, I think it is definitely achievable. I think it definitely comes down to, as we were discussing prior, people's values and their perception of shift work, whether or not they feel like victimized by a night shift or they feel really empowered by it. Like, everyone is so different. I think there is definitely small things that we can implement to soften the blow of shift work, which is what I'm spending a lot of my time researching and finding really good peer-reviewed evidence and like correct nutrition and sleep studies and everything like that to soften the blow of that. I think for me personally, because I was living in Queensland and working in New South Wales, my work-life balance was unachievable for those night shifts and 12-hour shifts. So, but that was my own prerogative. Like, I chose to live in Queensland with my partner. I knew I was working in New South Wales. I knew it was going to be hard. So I think your living arrangements definitely make a profound impact on that. So I think, you know, definitely it is achievable because people can do it for 25 years and not be affected by it at all. But I think it takes a lot of trial and error and reprioritization of your goals, life, and values in order to achieve that. It's not something that you can just sort of walk into and be like, yeah, this works fine for me. Definitely takes time. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it can be achieved to an extent, because as you say, I think living arrangement is a massive thing, and your proximity to your work. 100%. For me, so annoying because lockdown's over, the free work is over. So now I'm back to getting the train. So that means an hour, 2 hours of my day is kinda not wasted, but spent traveling to work on the train, just because driving in the city is very busy and parking is very expensive. So, you know, when I was driving to work and there was less traffic, it was so much more achievable, and I was oh, this is amazing. But now I'm remembering I'm gonna have to wake up at 5:15 now for a 7 a.m. start, and you know, that just makes me feel quite sad, because I'm you know, I've been enjoying that extra little sleep in and things like that. So I guess for me, I'm sort of reevaluating my sort of, you know, living situation. I'm sort of thinking should I move out closer to work, because I love the hospital that I work at and I would love to work there long term, and the hospitals to me and things like that, but they just don't have the same as what my hospital does. And yeah, it's hard because it's do I choose to work at a hospital that's 5 minutes from my house, or one that's you know, a good 40-minute drive? You know, you've got to pick your and, you know, decide what's most important to you. Are you going to sacrifice a bit of sleep to work, or can you settle for another hospital that you might still love but you don't know what it's like?
That's so, exactly.
Yeah.
Your decisions come into it 100%.
Yeah, and I think, but once you sort of get that down pat and you've got a routine, I feel like I, to be honest, have really enjoyed lockdown, to be honest. I think I'm just so used to it now. I've got a really good routine, to go on my walks and do my workout and do whatever it is I do on my days, and then go for walks with friends and things like that. And now it's how am I going to add in more social events into my already busy life, you know? And
yes,
how do you prioritize that sort of, that's a different type of work-life balance, because you know, if I was doing night shifts over the weekends in lockdown, I wouldn't, you know, I'd be like, oh, whatever, that's great. But now that there's more things opening up, it's is this what my life is going to be like forever? Am I going to be missing out on things because I'm doing shift work? So I guess a lot of it sort of plays on my
definitely. It's that fear of missing out as well that comes back when everything opens up. You're like, oh, I'm missing out on so much more now.
Yeah, and it's,
yeah,
I suppose you'll never know until you're in that situation, but
yeah.
And I sort of wanted to touch on how do you look after your mental health yourself, with shift work and also attending traumatic.
Yeah, so that's been a work in progress over my 2 years, and even during university it took me a while to find a system that worked for me. But the biggest thing that impacts my mental health is my hours of sleep that I get the day before. So when I am under fatigue, I feel really lethargic, which leads me to feel depressed and anxious. It just sort of snowballs. So for me, in terms of looking after my mental health, that would be prioritizing my sleep and adequate nutrition and fitting in socializing and time for the gym. So really prioritizing my sleep is something that really assists me with protecting my mental health. The other part of that question, in terms of how I deal with traumatic jobs, it's funny because when you do see something really horrific, your brain can sort of suppress the memory for a little bit because it is really hard to compartmentalize, and then it can come up 6 or 12 months later. So something that I worked out was when I do go to, and trigger warning, but a suicide attempt or a hanging or anything like that, I'll speak to someone immediately, while the memories are still in my prefrontal cortex and they're still fresh, so that they don't become suppressed and then pop up as like PTSD 6 months later.
Yeah.
So I think it's like being really honest with myself, like, okay, it hasn't impacted me now, I'm sleeping fine, but I know that in 6 months this is going to rear its head and it's not going to be pretty. So attacking it while it's still fresh. So like I keep a journal, and then I have a psychologist that I trust, and I speak to her. When I was on road, I'd speak to her every few weeks and just sort of debrief and get those memories into like an organized memory file instead of just sitting there being suppressed. So that's something that I really recommend, is like, even if you feel like it's not impacting you now, you have to remember that that's a trauma that you've just been to, and it can become a trauma for your brain. It can lead to PTSD, and you don't want to burn out and have PTSD and being capable of working. So it's really important to stay on top of it.
Yeah, that's really important. And I think, yeah, it's very, you know, important to work out how to, you know, deal with it all, because, you know, whether it be seeing a psychologist, which I think is very important, and especially finding what works well for you, because I was seeing one and I don't know, it just didn't click, and then I just never made another appointment, and I feel like, you know, maybe I should try again and find someone. But yeah, it's just finding, you know, how to release those emotions, and, you know, debriefing is so important, you know, whether it be like something that seems like a insignificant, like it might be just a little event, whether, or, you know, a really, you know, big one. So yeah, talking it out is important.
Talking it out is really important. And also I love that comment that you just made, like, about finding the right psychologist, because it's the same as finding a friend. You know, you're going to tell this person truths and everything, you know, you want to have a good connection with them. I had to see 3 or 4 before I was like, okay, this person gets me. Love her. She's great. So don't be scared to, yeah, definitely try until you find someone that clicks, because you will. It's only a matter of time. But I know it can be really scary when you walk into a psychologist's office and you have to like give them a debrief of your life. It's like very, it's a very,
but I think there's one more interested in, and it was like, how do you prevent like mental health day from affecting like your shift or work in general?
And that is a really good question. I think in our job, you know, as a nurse or a paramedic, you really do have to be switched on. And if you are experiencing a bad mental health day where you literally need to cocoon yourself in a doona and go to sleep, I think it's really important to take sick leave or take mental health leave.
Yeah. Oops, I think I lost you. Yeah.
I think like
that's right.
It's inevitable that we're going to have days where your mental health is impacted or you're under exhaustion and fatigue, where you do actually need to take a day off. So that concept of how do you let it not affect your shift or your work, it inevitably will affect your shift. And it's really important to know your boundaries and limits. Like if you are having a bad mental health day, like you need to, it's your body telling you like you need to take a rest, you need to take time out. So acting prophylactically with those things, like noticing your red flags and warning signs that you're sort of slipping into that state, or it's becoming coming to a point where it's really affecting you, I think it's important to hit it on the head and not let it progress, because with any sort of decline in your mental health or like a mental illness diagnosis, the longer that you leave it, the worse it becomes, and it becomes more treatment resistant. So it's really important to be prophylactic about that, 100%.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that, like, to take a sick day, you don't have to be necessarily like sick with a flu or, you know, nauseous or, you know, whatever it is that you're feeling sick from. Like you can be feeling like run down sick, you know, and I've like taken a mental health day, and, you know, I just told the doctor I just need a mental health day today, and they, you know, signed and gave me a medical certificate. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that, like, sometimes like sick days can be used for whatever it is that's making you feel unwell, you know. 100%. I think it's important to remember that.
100%. And honestly, like every GP that I've ever been to, they'll be more than happy to sign that off as well, because it is definitely just as valid, as important as a physiological, like physical sickness, 100%.
You know, as GPs, you would hope they understand, you know. I was like, I'm a nurse and I've just had enough. I just need
a little break. They'll be like, no worries. Take as much time as you need. It's fine. Yeah, they are really receptive to it. So it is important to feel comfortable to do that because they will support you 100%.
Yeah, exactly. And just finally, I just wanted to discuss, like, you recently resigned from your job as a paramedic despite, you know, all your passion to beginning your journey as one. If you don't mind sharing, like, why did you resign and what are sort of your future plans at the moment?
Yeah, no problem at all. I'm pretty much an open book. So that's so fine that you asked that. And I think it did spark a bit of intrigue because it's quite rare for someone that's 25 to retire. So at the inception of my career, my main goal was to work out west, like where my uncle passed away. And I was fortunate enough to actually do that in my first year on road. So I was really zoned in on achieving that, and I was lucky enough to do it in the first year. So I was like, okay, that's what I came here to do. It was kind of like this philanthropical sort of drive to get closure and help the farmers. And mm-hmm. I felt like I did that, and I saw so much. It was like such a trauma-based station that I was at, and I got to use all the skills that I wanted to. I like ticked everything off. I was like, yep, okay, great. And it was never a career that I thought would be lifelong, and I don't know if that's untoward to say or frowned upon, but it's not something that I thought that I would do forever. I always thought that I would be in a job that I would be paid with my ideas on a salary instead of something that I was paid for by the hour. That's mm-hmm. just something that I always wanted to achieve because I felt quite limited in the fact that, you know, I can work as hard as I possibly can. I can come up with all these ideas and research as much as I want, but I'll still be paid X amount an hour. Mm-hmm. So like that cap and inability to like work towards another goal. I didn't want to be an intensive care paramedic and I didn't want to go into management. So for me personally, there was not much room for growth for me in that role. Like it would be the same thing every week for the rest of my life, and I just felt like I wanted more. I'm also so passionate about education, and I think everything that I went through on road, like I want to use those lessons and instill them into the younger paramedics to prevent them from going through burnout and being like diagnosed with PTSD at a young age, because that's not something that I'd wish on anyone. And if I had someone that, you know, said to me like, you need to take a mental health day, or these are your red flags, or this is how you deal with this, and this is how to protect a patient's mental health and be respectful, this is the language that you use, etc. If I had that mentor, I would have probably stayed in the job for about 5 years, but the shelf mm-hmm. life for me was definitely two. I saw what I needed to see. I felt like I did what I wanted, came there to do, and I'm just really excited to start a new chapter in my life.
Exciting. I think that, you know, you shouldn't like feel bad at all, and I'm sure you don't, but like for, you know, retiring after only a short amount of time, like everyone, you know, has different preferences, and you know there's no right way to do anything in life, you know, like there's no right way of how you know, love your job or whatever. And I think like it's really important to like recognize like what it is that you loved about your job, and then, you know, you can continue doing that and not feel burnt out or, you know, regretful for continuing on despite feeling tired.
That's exactly right. And I never wanted to be a practitioner or a clinician that you'd meet and you just thought, man, they're so burnt out. Like I never, ever, ever, I never wanted to be that person. And I promised myself when I got into the job, like whether or not it's a week or 10 years into it, if I get to that stage where I want to do something else, you need to do it straight away, because it's not fair on the patients, it's not fair on their family, it's not fair on your colleagues. Like when you are burnt out and you're tired of it, if you're in healthcare, like leave your job. That's so harsh. That is so, and I accept that people have different life circumstances and they need an income. I totally respect that, but definitely check your options, because it's not fair on the patients.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Like I think like my mum's a nurse, and then my partner, his dad's a paramedic, and his mum's a nurse, and like I do see that burnt outness in him, and he's just like on annual leave for 4 weeks now, and he's just, you know, relaxing on the couch every day and doing little things around the house. But you know, I do wonder, like, does he his job sometimes, you know, because it's Like, it would be hard, and, you know, I'm sure he doesn't debrief enough with his family about everything. But yeah, it's like, how do you keep going? Like, do you still not? I don't know.
Literally. No, that's no judgment to anyone that's still in it when they're burnt out. But just personally, I just didn't want to get to that stage because it's not very nice to be around as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you hoping to do going forward? Like, education, would you want to work with, like, at unis, or, you know, run little seminars, or, like, you haven't really decided, just looking for anything?
Yeah, well, I actually was lucky enough. I start my new job on Monday. So that was,
oh, exciting.
I know. I actually, yeah, I only had a week and a half off until, like, I resigned, and then I'm starting my new job. So that's awesome. And I'll be working. Yeah, I'll be working at a college in Queensland. So
amazing.
Dream job. I know, dream job.
And it's nice and close to home.
I know. And the hours are like 8 to 4. And I'm just like, what even is life? I'll be able to go to the gym and get a coffee before I start. I'll be able to go to the beach after work. Like, the smallest things are like such a novelty to me. And I don't think they'll wear off for a couple of years, because I know what it's like to miss out on so much. So I'm so excited, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So happy for you. I'm excited to see all the posts and, you know, see all your excitement and everything. I think, yeah, like 8 to 4, like, some people, you know, say, oh, 9 to 5, that sucks. But, like,
I'm like, to be honest,
I would love that.
Like, I can get a coffee before work. Like, I can go to the gym. Like, that's unheard of. Like, what?
You know, for a morning shift, I'm just completely dead afterwards. Like, I just can't really do much. But then when I've got a PM, like, I kind of love them because, yeah, I can go to the gym. Well, not because we're in lockdown usually, but, you know, to go for a walk and do something, you know, fun in the morning, I suppose, and then go to work. But, yeah, that's amazing.
Thank you. Very, very exciting.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to finish off with, any inspirational quotes or anything?
My favorite inspirational quote, I will share it because I love it so much. It is actually a quote from Audrey Hepburn, I believe, but it says, nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. And that is something that I cherish so much. Yeah, in healthcare, I know that there can be quite a bit of imposter syndrome, and you can feel like quite inferior around just seeing your colleagues and everything. But just remember, it comes down to you. And if someone is trying to make you feel inferior, they actually physically can't do that unless you let them. So, yeah, if someone gives you a piece of advice and you don't agree with it, or they're making you feel really bad about yourself, well, that's on them, not you. So carry on.
I love that. Thank you. That's a really nice quote. And yeah, when you unpack it, it's so true. Like, you know,
yeah,
you don't make anyone feel bad about anything. You know, we shouldn't let them do that.
No, that's 100% correct. So that would be my parting quote.
Well, thank you so much, Georgia, for joining me on my podcast. I'm sure everyone is going to absolutely love this episode because, yeah, we discussed lots of important things that would be relevant to, you know, many of the nurses listening. It, like, they don't have to be a paramedic to, you know, feel what we discussed. And yeah, it was amazing. Thank you
so much for having me, and I think this is such an amazing thing that you're doing, and I wish that I had this podcast with you talking me through these concepts when I was at uni. So this is amazing. Thank you for having me.
No worries. Thank you. Have a lovely day. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
Bye.